Like all the controls on this remote unit, the volume is fully variable. Should the telephone ring or guests arrive,
I would like to welcome Jim Manning, who is an emergency physician and associate professor at the Chapel Hill Hospital in North Carolina. And you've been studying arterial catheters in the aorta to try to control the perfusion of the aortic arch during arrest, cardiac arrest and in trauma. Is it true?
Yes. That are the things. Okay. All right, great. Thank you very much. Well, thank you for coming, and it's an honor and pleasure to be here. It's really been a wonderful morning. I've really enjoyed it. So, I'll tell you what I've been doing. I'm a resuscitation researcher, or I use a new term, sort of resuscitationist. And what I've been working on for almost three decades now is a resuscitation technique called selective aortic arch perfusion, which I suspect none of you have ever heard of, or barely heard of. So I'll just try to describe what this is. Selective aortic arch perfusion is a technique where you take a balloon occlusion catheter and place it in a femoral artery, blindly pass it up into the thoracic aorta. And so long as that balloon is between the diaphragm and the left subclavian artery, when you blow the balloon up, you have relatively selected out the heart and the brain to perfuse the heart and brain with an oxygen carrier during cardiac arrest. The intent being to perfuse the heart well enough to get the heart beating again and to keep the brain alive as well, since we want people to be able to play the piano or do whatever it is that they normally did before their cardiac arrest. And so that's the fundamental technique. If you look at this, if you're familiar with what the new technique, a relatively new technique in trauma called REBOA, it looks a lot like that. The major difference is that the catheter that we're using has a larger internal lumen, which allows you to actually perfuse fluid through the catheter at a rate of up to a liter a minute, which makes it a larger catheter than what the REBOA catheters are. So now, like I said, this is something I've actually been working on for quite some time. This is the original article. My first presentation ever of this, I was at the Royal College of Surgeons, Edinburgh, in 1990. So I'm rapidly approaching 30 years of tinkering with this idea. And this is the original article. What has happened in relatively recent years, because I really kind of worked on this in obscurity for, I would say, about 23 years. The initial impressions were when I told people, well, let's say, in 1990, when I said, I want to go into the field, I want to put an aortic catheter in people's, in cardiac arrest, in the thoracic aorta, perfuse their hearts and brains, people looked at me sort of cross-eyed and said, we're never going to do this, you're wasting your time, and tried to suggest that I do something else with my research life. But what has happened in recent years, and we've kind of watched this happen, is as we've had the endovascular revolution, vascular surgeons now do so many of their operations endovascularly and place stents all the time, interventional radiology, interventional cardiology. The idea of actually accessing with vascular catheters and doing interventions has certainly, you know, grown on us. And two things have really happened in relatively recent years. Let's say in the last like 6 to 8 years, there's been two camps that have been sort of moving together, I think, a bit in terms of endovascular resuscitation. One is in hemorrhage control. The military vascular surgeons began to recognize with the injuries they saw in Afghanistan and Iraq that a lot of these had injuries where they could not get tourniquets, direct pressure, torso hemorrhages, and they were losing patients. So they took the technique that they used in AAAs of using balloon occlusion for hemorrhage control while they deployed stents for ruptured AAAs, and said, why don't we use this for trauma patients, and especially in the combat casualty care scenarios. And so the concept of REBOA, or resuscitative endovascular balloon occlusion, came along. On the other side, the idea of using extracorporeal perfusion, so ECMO with the devices, transport ECMO devices, they're much smaller, portable, the idea of using them for medical cardiac arrest, it began to grow in recent years. And so these two are sort of coming together, and sort of at the bottom, this is what we call sort of they're converging on what we call sort of an interventional toolkit of endovascular extracorporeal resuscitation techniques. REBOA, as I mentioned, is aortic occlusion. This is the original paper from 2011. that described the technique and talked about zone one and zone three as two sites for the use of balloon occlusion hemorrhage control and trauma. Just very quickly, in case you're not familiar with this, zone one is the idea of taking the balloon and placing it in the thoracic aorta, blowing up the balloon. You have then got hemorrhage control for anything below the level of the diaphragm. So any abdominal hemorrhage that's non-compressible or pelvic hemorrhage would be controlled, at least the arterial hemorrhage would be controlled by balloon occlusion. If, however, it's clear from zone three, as the other is where if it's clear that you have an isolated pelvic injury, you can place the catheter in the infrarenal aorta and get hemorrhage control for the pelvis. And this is considered zone three ROBOA. And the Royal London Hospital, our colleagues in London, actually use this technique in the field. They actually gone and this is actually a case report of a young woman that actually got zone three ROBOA in the field who was a survivor. And so these are techniques that one can help us in trauma, but also can actually be potentially done in the pre-hospital care setting. ECMO, of course, I realize I'm standing in one of the premier institutions for ECMO in the world, one of the very first. So I don't really need to say much about ECMO. The world's experts are here. But this has been now used in more and more in cardiac arrest care. So the idea of ECMO during cardiac arrest or extracorporeal CPR has been growing. And our colleagues over in Paris, who have the physician staff ambulances in the field, set up a special unit just to go out and actually put people on ECMO in the field in cardiac arrest. And they're the first center to actually do this. And this is an example of a patient that's being put on ECMO that I took his photo while I was visiting the SAMU about a year and a half or so ago. And you look at this and say, well, where are they? Well, they're in a corridor in a train station, putting a patient in cardiac arrest on ECMO. So it just goes to show that we can actually do remarkably advanced procedures in the field to try to resuscitate patients. And for me, this is all very exciting because that's what I want to do. This has been my interest almost for 30 years. The interesting thing about selective aortic arch perfusion is that it sort of has a foot in both camps. It's a balloon occlusion catheter that gives you potential hemorrhage control, but also has the perfusion capability for treating cardiac arrest and hopefully getting restoration of spontaneous circulation in a patient that has actually had cardiac arrest. Now, and it is a technique that could be used for both medical and traumatic cardiac arrest. This is just a picture of one of the catheters, but an ECMO cannula beside. This is an earlier iteration, a fairly simple one for the laboratory, but it was working fairly effectively. Don't know if I, at least as you can see where, and this is actually a larger catheter. We have a smaller catheter now, but you can see sort of relative size of, say, this aortic catheter, a balloon occlusion catheter, as opposed to, say, a 15 and a 19 French arterial ECMO cannula. So the idea is to be able to get a relatively small catheter in, get adequate perfusion, get return of circulation, hopefully be able to pull the catheter and stop. But yet, if they still need ongoing extracorporeal support, you can use this as a bridge until you can get the cannulas in that you need to convert to whole body ECMO. It's one of the concepts. Now, this will hopefully work. It should. Okay. This is a fluoroscopic view of selective aortic arch perfusion, and there we go. You can see we got the balloon occlusion, the aortic valve closes, you get the coronary arteries filling. And you look down toward the right lower side, you'll begin to see the coronary sinus as the flow is moving from the coronary sinus into the right atrium. So this is an example of showing in a laboratory setting in a cardiac arrest model what the perfusion looks like. One of the things we learned in the early experiments trying to do this is that one of the critical things for getting optimal coronary artery perfusion is you have to close the aortic valve. So I'm just going to show you just one more view. This is just one. If you watch this, I think it's just running on its own. Maybe not. Let me see it. If you watch the infusion, you'll see that the aortic valve closes, and then immediately as soon as the aortic valve slams shut, the coronary arteries perfuse. If I can just get it to run. This is curious. All right. Well, let me try that. Okay. Let me try this one more time. Okay. Let's see. Okay. And if you watch, aortic valve closes, coronaries perfuse. And in some of these where we did it at a lower infusion rate where the aortic valve didn't close, if you don't close the aortic valve, the path of least resistance is from the aorta into the left ventricle, left atrium, and back into the pulmonary circuit. You get a beautiful pulmonary venogram, but you're not perfusing the coronaries. So the technique that we use for this is to do a rapid bolus, close the aortic valve, and then we can perfuse at a lower perfusion rate, maintain closure of the aortic valve, and get excellent coronary artery perfusion. Okay, so now it's going to play. Okay, there you go. So you can see that the aortic valve closes, the coronary is perfused, you can see where the aortic occlusion is, the closed valve, and coronary sinus and everything. Okay, we'll play the second time. Okay, this is a little off the screen here, but what I'm trying to actually demonstrate here is that we did color microsphere flow studies during a ventricular fibrillation cardiac arrest and to see what kind of flows we would get with SAP. And this over here is baseline. This is before cardiac arrest. And although it's off the screen, you can see sort of the regional blood flow. This is sort of the level of blood flow that we had. When we did ventricular fibrillation and waited 10 minutes, then started to do CPR, well, the blood flow to the myocardium during just regular external CPR is down here. It's just off the screen. But then we tested two or three different types of techniques, did a little minor variations on how to do selective aortic perfusion. But the key thing I wanted to show you is that these are the flows that we got with SAP during cardiac arrest. As you can see here, not only have we gotten better flows, CPR blood flow has been shown that if you do CPR well early, you can get maybe 25 to 30% of normal blood flow. With this technique, we actually get not just 100%, we actually get supernormal blood flow. We can actually generate more flow to the myocardium than the heart's getting when it's beating on its own. And one of the questions is, well, how in the world could you possibly do that? But in a cardiac arrest state, the heart's not beating. Since we normally get our hearts get perfusion during the diastolic phase of the cardiac cycle, we're only getting diastolic flow. But in an arrested heart that's not beating, you can perfuse it continuously. And I think that's how we're actually able to. We get good perfusion to the brain, but not supernormal flow. But we can get supernormal flow to the myocardium. But what I think that allows us to do is to actually get the heart started again really fast because we've got such robust flow. Now, the concept of how to do this is it would, you get to a patient, get this catheter in, and hopefully you would have an exogenous oxygen carrier with you. That could be a fluorocarbon-based oxygen carrier, hemoglobin-based oxygen carrier. Since we don't have any of those available right now, we're looking at using whole blood or packed red blood cells. So, but something that carries oxygen, we've tested all of those, all of them work. The first thing you would do is get to the patient, get the balloon in, blow that up, and begin to infuse in oxygenated, whatever your carrier is. You begin to infuse that up to some limit. You can probably do this in, say, a medical cardiac arrest for up to about 2, 3, maybe 4 minutes, depending on whether you do it continuously or intermittently. And hopefully, during that span of time, you actually get return spontaneous circulation. If it's VFib, you get the VFib energy pattern strong enough to where you can defibrillate them and the heart actually starts beating again on its own. Then you can stop. However, if you don't get return spontaneous circulation just with the exogenous oxygen carrier, the next step was during that 2, 3, 4 minutes that you're doing the initial infusion with this, you get venous access, you can begin to pull off their own venous blood from the femoral vein, set up a circuit it's essentially like ECMO. I had actually called it autologous blood sap when I started doing this almost 30 years ago, but essentially it's ECMO to your aortic arch. It's the same thing, we're just isolating the aortic arch. You continue that perfusion until you get return of spontaneous circulation. Once the heart starts beating again in a medical cardiac arrest where there's no hemorrhage control issue here, as soon as you get return of spontaneous circulation, you get the balloon down as fast as possible, almost immediately, hopefully with the heart actually being strong enough to maintain adequate perfusion on its own. However, another option that we have in this sort of stepwise process would be if we get return of spontaneous circulation with autologous blood, but the heart's not beating really well, and it needs a little bit more support. We can just let the balloon down, just deflate the balloon, then we're perfusing the entire body. But we're only going to be able to perfuse at about a liter per minute. 800 mils to a liter per minute is about the maximum we would actually be able to give with this catheter. If a patient actually needs full body perfusion support for an extended period of time, this is not going to be able to do that. But we could use this as a bridge to give partial support while the heart's beating until you get in arterial and venous large enough, ECMO cannulas, true ECMO cannulas that will allow you to then convert them to full body ECMO. And that's the concept sort of here. So part of it is the idea is that I think we could use selective aortic arch perfusion to get return of spontaneous circulation in a number of our cardiac arrest patients, hopefully by putting in just an aortic catheter very quickly, doing perfusion just with an exogenous oxygen carrier. And if that works, great, you stop. However, if they haven't gotten return of circulation yet, you can then convert to autologous blood sap, continue to do this for a few more minutes and hopefully get return of circulation. If you do and they're stable, stop. If that's not adequate, you let the balloon down, you continue to perfuse with limited, like up to a liter a minute, while you bridge them to put in your larger cannulas for full body VA ECMO. And so in doing so, the idea is to use an intervention that will actually give you adequate perfusion, and then you escalate to the level of, that the individual patient needs. And I'm a big fan of ECMO, I really am. ECPR, I think, is absolutely fantastic. But I think most would agree is if you can actually quickly get return of circulation and they don't have to be on VA ECMO for days, it'd be better to avoid VA ECMO. If they need it, we can bridge them to take them to VA ECMO. So that's sort of the overall concept. Escalate to the level of care that the patient actually needs. Now, I developed this technique initially. The idea came to me, I worked on it in medical cardiac arrest models like ventricular fibrillation. And it worked well. I mean, it really works well in the laboratory setting. We close the aortic valve, get perfusion. We were getting return of spontaneous circulation after like 10 minutes of ventricular fibrillation and then doing perfusion for like 2 minutes, shocking, getting the hearts back. So it worked well in those ventricular fibrillation models. However, I began to think about it and say, you know, it is a volume loading procedure, you're volume limited. It works for medical cardiac arrest, but gosh, this thing is like made to order for trauma. I mean, the aortic cross clamp effect, well, actually, I should just go ahead and throw this up. So what happens? So the balloon itself, much like Reboa, like you said we were doing it years before, it acts as an aortic cross clamp. So if there's hemorrhage below the level of the diaphragm, that balloon actually acts like the cross clamp that we would do during a thoracotomy. You get perfusion to the heart and the brain, which is actually pretty robust, as I've just shown you, probably better than what you can get by squeezing the heart. And if the reason that they've gone into a cardiac arrest is a hemorrhage-induced arrest where they've lost 30, 40, maybe almost 50% of their circulating blood volume, at the rates we're pushing at 10 mL per kilo per minute, we can actually restore the intravascular volume in a matter of about 3 to 4 minutes. And that's typically what we've seen in our laboratory models. The other thing you can do is because you've got this intra-aortic catheter, you can actually use things like adrenaline, maybe other drugs, maybe anti-reperfusion agents. There's a whole pharmacology potentially to this that we haven't actually worked out yet, but you do have the opportunity to give intra-aortic medications. And so the first report, oh yes.
Yes, a brief question. What about the time aspect to get the catheter in place versus to do a thoracotomy? Thoracotomy is a pretty rapid procedure. I suppose you're well trained at this, but how long does it take actually to get the balloon in place?
Actually, once you have femoral arterial access, mm-hmm. it probably takes 30 to 60 seconds to put the balloon in. But the vascular access is one of the key things. So the question is, do you do it percutaneously? Do you do it by cut down in order to get the catheter in quickly? And that's a fair question because that's probably the rate limiting step. And so one of the things we're actually working is trying to work toward techniques and things like that will actually allow you to get rapid, consistent vascular access, especially for thinking about doing this in the field. Now, obviously, the London Air Ambulance, and I'm sure other places do, they'll do thoracotomies in the field if need be. Optimally, I think if you could, you'd rather not do a clamshell thoracotomy in the field. I mean, you can do it, and they've had survivors, but it's a big procedure out on the street. If we could actually fundamentally do the same thing through a femoral artery cut down or percutaneous with good access very quickly and do this, maybe that's a better procedure. At least we'll see.
Another practical question would be the placement of the catheter, because if you don't have access to fluoroscopy,
right.
We do it blindly. And is that a problem, really? I mean, practically, is it misplaced?
Right. The only way, I think, in almost most all instances, the answer should be no. So long as you get the artery, not the vein. This will not work very well if you put it in the vena cava. But if you get it in the femoral artery, it's a relatively straight shot up to the aorta. And the size of the catheter, it's not real flexible, so it's not likely to go down a renal. You're probably going to feel the difference. But then the thing is so long as you get the balloon above the level of the diaphragm, fundamentally, the hemodynamic effects are going to be pretty much the same. And what I found is if you go from like xiphosternal junction to the umbilicus to your insertion site and the groin, if you measure that out and put that in, you're just above the diaphragm. And anywhere between the diaphragm and the left subclavian, fundamentally hemodynamically, it's going to be the same. So it's not like you have to get it in a space this tight. You've actually got some distance. So I think that allows this to be a technique that you could do blindly in the field. Yes?
What's the difference in outcome if you just do the balloon and not do the more resource time sensitive with the ECMO one and the autologous blood and oxygen, just the balloon?
Right. It's a good question. And the thing is, it depends on what the state is, the state is. If it is a cardiac arrest where the heart has stopped beating, mm-hmm. the balloon actually doesn't do. I mean, honestly, if you have some, let's say you have profound hypotension. I actually get to talk about this next week at this EBTM meetings. But how do we define cardiac arrest, say, in trauma? If you can't feel pulses and say, oh, they're in a cardiac arrest, we start to do CPR. But their systolic pressure may actually be, or mean pressure may be like 30 around that. So they're profoundly hypotensive, but the heart's still beating. If the heart has truly stopped beating and you're in a cardiac arrest and your arterial pressure is down to, say, like 10, when you blow up the balloon, nothing really happens. So you're then dependent on CPR to generate blood flow. You can get IVs and push. This is in trauma. Yeah. This would be in trauma. So, and if you've already got a profoundly hypovolemic state, the data that we do have suggests that CPR is not very effective in profound hypovolemia and hemorrhage. So for a hemorrhagic shock cardiac arrest, I'd say the perfusion really adds something important. The balloon alone isn't really adequate. There's a debate about whether balloon occlusion alone would be helpful in augmenting CPR. May have a moment to talk about that a little bit later, right at the end. I think it depends on what the coronary perfusion pressure is when you do blow up the balloon. If it's really low, blowing up the balloon ain't going to do very much.
But if you're borderline, in hospital, you should open the chest and give blood.
Right, but actually, well, I don't know. This is one thing we have to find. So I would argue that if you can get a catheter like this in very, very fast, and if you've got the oxygen carrier with you, if I can actually put this in, resuscitate you just as fast with this as you can with a thoracotomy, and you avoid the thoracotomy, not against it. I've done a number of thoracotomies along the way, but it's a big procedure. And if I could actually do just as well with this, and you get to the OR, get surgical hemostasis, and avoid having to have like a clamshell thoracotomy, I think that's probably a benefit to the patient. We'll know that when we get into clinicals. We're pushing to get into the clinical trials in the next year, and we'll be able to begin to answer how well do we do with this such that we're able to avoid thoracotomy.
But if you look at the number of patients that CPR patient, non-trauma is huge.
Yep.
Compared to the trauma case.
Yep.
So it just to gain a couple of percentage of better outcome with just putting in the balloon, mm-hmm. not doing the oxygenated thing, would still be a big thing for the general CPR
Potentially. I don't think we know the answer to that yet. And I guess this is probably because I have a little bit of bias when I'm working on this. I can tell you that the perfusion is so much better. My question is, if you're going to go to the trouble of putting a balloon catheter into the aorta to try to improve your CPR blood flow, which you probably may be able to take your coronary perfusion pressure from, say, 15 up to 25, why not let me do this and I can actually get supernormal flow and hopefully get you back in 2 minutes. And that's that. But there are people who are interested in looking at, say, for example, because what you're saying is Reboa during CPR. And there are people who are trying to look at that now. And the data, I think what you find when you look at the data on this in laboratory studies, there's a wide range of what happens. And I think the big issue, I'll just go and address it now, is that I think it depends on where your coronary perfusion pressure is. And this is sort of one of our dilemmas, along with adrenaline. It's like, if you're doing CPR and you've got a coronary perfusion pressure of, say, 30 or 40 millimeters of mercury, you don't need any of this because you're probably going to get them back. That's a great perfusion pressure. You're likely to get them back. If their perfusion pressure is 5 or 10 because they're so vasodilated, the balloon's not going to do anything probably to improve your CPR very much. You're only going to get 2 or 3 millimeters of mercury out of that. If you're on the borderline, like the traditional teaching, both in what we found both in laboratory and humans, is that if you have a coronary perfusion pressure of right about 15, you need to be above 15 to get return of circulation. If it's right at 15 and you can jump it up and you can bump it up to 20 or 25, if you're in that range, there the balloon itself might actually have a benefit. But that's only a small subset of the overall medical cardiac arrest population. That's my impression from my laboratory science and what I've done. If you've got a balloon in there, you can actually do perfusion. It didn't matter whether their coronary perfusion pressure was 10 or 20. I'm going to be able to take over the perfusion with this.
Would that be taken into account with giving fluid on the venous side parallel? Because that could actually increase the output on the arterial side. if you give fluid during the CPR, in this case?
If you're giving fluid, like with a balloon occlusion, giving intravenous fluid and stuff, maybe, but you still have to have that arterial gradient in order to actually drive the blood flow. So it probably has some effect, but so far, at least as far as I can tell, I think if I can actually take over, because essentially I'm doing extracorporeal perfusion with this, this still, I think, is more robust in terms of blood flow. But it's a research question, it's a clinical question that I think is that people are beginning to try to ask that. So it's a valid question. I don't have a clear-cut answer in humans for you, though. All right, so I'll move right along here. This is a study we did with HVOG. It was the first study that we did in a traumatic cardiac arrest model, and we used a hemoglobin-based oxygen carrier. It worked very well. We basically bled these animals down to like 40% of their normal circulating blood volume. They went into a Brady asystolic arrest after about 12 minutes. We then left them for 3 minutes in asystole, then began to do this infusion, and we were able to resuscitate all six of them in average about 2 minutes. And all we had to do was perfuse with the oxygenated hemoglobin, no CPR, no, we did not require any epinephrine in any of those, just the perfusion with the oxygenated fluid was enough to get the electrical activity to come back and the heart to start beating adequately. So that's the sort of thing we've done. Of course, the problem is that we don't have a hemoglobin or a fluorocarbon-based oxygen carrier now presently available that we can readily use. So we've gone back and actually looked at, well, let's look at the only oxygen carriers we do have, which are whole blood impact red cells. And they work very well. It's just that the logistics of using those, especially if you're trying to go into the pre-hospital care setting, makes it more complicated. So we will be able to move this, say, in pre-hospital much more easily if we actually have a hemoglobin available. This is an example of what we see when we're doing like blood, and we have to match it with some intra-aortic calcium because we have to counteract the citrate at the moment where we're doing this. But we can, and this is an example, this is an artifact down here, but basically we have asystole. We begin to do the perfusion. Here's the bolus to close the aortic valve. Then we're perfusing. And then the first thing we see the electrical activity come back. The electrical activity gets faster and faster, and then the heart starts beating again. So this is sort of typically what we see in our traumatic or hemorrhagic shock cardiac arrest model. We have had some instances where we begin to do the perfusion, we get the electrical activity come back, but even after a couple minutes or so, the heart just really hasn't started to kick yet. But one of the benefits we have an arterial cannula sitting there, so we can actually push in small doses of intra-aortic adrenaline in order to help sort of kickstart the heart. And in this is an example where we actually have this perfusion. We know we're perfusing. We've gotten the electrical activity back. The myocardial contractility hasn't come back. So we give a little bump of just 250 micrograms of intra-aortic adrenaline. And within about 15 seconds or so, we begin to see the heart really beating again. I think we kind of get the anotropic effect back. So this is one of the optional things that you can do as part of the trial of resuscitation that you can do with this catheter. Now, I'm going to show you. I show a lot of data and graphs and stuff. I'm sorry, do you have a question? Yes.
Have you done this as well with some longer time? This was 3 minutes after assisting.
This is like profound hypotension, they're shocky for like several minutes, then they go into a complete arrest, like Brady asystolic arrest. Okay. Then you leave them in asystole for 3 minutes and then start to do this. So have I gone longer? I've taken medical cardiac arrests and animal hearts out to 25 minutes of normothermic arrest with no CPR and still been able to get the hearts beating again. Now those are hearts that don't have coronary disease. That's a very hard model. But you can take a very ischemic prolonged heart and you can potentially with this get the heart beating again. We've done that. So this is a lab model. I'm going to show you an example where we actually did a hemorrhage shock experiment. At the end of it, we did the resuscitation, everything went fine. We said, well, look, let's just open up the chest and do the whole thing again and videotape it and see what happens. And this is what you're going to see. And this is a case where another hemorrhagic shock arrest, left him for 4 minutes of cardiac arrest, standstill, nothing, and then began to do selective aortic arch perfusion with oxygenated whole blood. So you can see the heart here, and what you do is you're about to see it kind of bulge out a little bit as we start the sap infusion. There you go. You see the coronary arteries fill. Okay, so and obviously we have the heart open, we have the chest open, the balloon's up, we've got aortic cross clamp coverage, we have a hypovolemic animal here, and we are perfusing in oxygenated whole blood. Obviously we're not squeezing the heart, we are not giving any intra-aortic adrenaline with this, we are simply perfusing with oxygenated blood. The first thing you see, and I'm gonna redo this and I'm gonna have the EKG on across the top. We begin to see after about 15 seconds or so, we begin to see some EKG beats. The EKG keeps increasing, the rate gets faster. And basically what we've done is we've converted the this pig from asystole to a pulseless electrical activity rhythm. It's a normal EKG looking rhythm, but we've got no contractility. And that's because the myocardium isn't ready yet. We haven't been able to reverse the acidosis, the loss of ATP, all this. We need to give the heart a little more perfusion time to be able to start kicking. But at about 60 seconds of perfusion, the heart just starts beating again. And we've seen this repeatedly in our lab models. And so the hope is that we could do this. And I have been arguing for 30 years in terms of cardiac arrest resuscitation, if you look at our outcomes and stuff, that our outcomes are so low. And I have been arguing that the Achilles heel of our resuscitation efforts with ACLS has been perfusion. We can intubate people and we can ventilate them just fine. Our defibrillation techniques, whether it's monophasic or biphasic, work exceptionally well if you can defibrillate them very fast, like within the first 30, 60 seconds, it's almost 100%. So defibrillation works. Our ventilation works. Why do we give drugs like adrenaline? In order to improve perfusion. I mean, that's really the fundamental reason we give it, is to get vasoconstriction and raise the perfusion pressure. So the critical thing is perfusion. That's really been our Achilles heel, our limiting factor. And now with ECPR, and hopefully, I hope maybe with this tech, we can begin to address that perfusion deficit in a way that actually gives us a much greater chance of getting return of circulation and saving these patients. This is a study that was actually published in the past year in PLOS Medicine. It's again in a trauma model. This was done in collaboration with the United States Air Force Research Lab at San Antonio. And what we did was we did a comparison. This is a true cardiac arrest. I mean, asystole cardiac arrest. I mean, pressure of, you know, aortic pressure less than 10 millimeters of mercury. And we looked at what happened if you used Reboa in that true cardiac arrest state. We weren't able to get any of them back with Reboa. Interestingly, just doing selective aortic arch perfusion with lactated ringers, we were actually able to get some of them back fairly quickly just with lactated ringers, not necessarily a great oxygen carrier, but it's that perfusion. I think partly it's mixing with the blood that was already there, but we actually were able to get some of the hearts beating there. But the whole blood, when you put in an effective oxygen carrier, we're actually consistently able to get them, you know, these back. We did very, very well with these. And even when I talked to the ECMO folks yesterday, one of the comments was from Dr. Kenneth Palmer, and he was saying, is it so much the oxygen or is it just the perfusion that you need? And I think he's right. The big part of this is just perfusing well enough, washing out metabolic waste products and stuff. If you can just add some oxygen in there enough to kind of kickstart things, that the combination of oxygen and perfusion are key to actually allowing you to get return of circulation. Yes, sir.
Yes, out of curiosity, because I mean, you clearly provide oxygen to the hypoxic heart in this case, but then again, you have the reperfusion problem.
Right.
Have you thought about scavengers and, you know, to bring a cocktail into the heart?
I've been using the term the Bloody Mary for your ischemic heart and brain for almost as long as I've been thinking about this, recognizing that maybe the first thing that you actually push through the catheter, or when we push in the bolus to close the aortic valve, maybe that's not the oxygen carrier. Maybe it's a cocktail of anti-reperfusion agents, things like that. I've wanted to study it for a quarter century, but I got to get the funding to do it. And step one is to get it out there and try to save. But then I figure if for whatever is left of my research life, I'm going to be studying exactly that. It's what is it that we put in? What's the pharmacology that we can actually push in early to limit reactive oxygen species and optimize the chances of recovery both of the heart and the brain? Absolutely correct. I agree with you completely. I haven't had the money to study it. That's just been the reality. But hopefully that will change if we can show some success with this. This is just sort of a template of saying how would you actually use this? Because Reboa is out there. That's a balloon occlusion for hemorrhage control. That's out there. SAP, hopefully we can get this into clinical practice. And there's something called EPR, emergency preservation resuscitation, which if you haven't heard of that, fundamentally it's profound hypothermia. You actually push in ice cold saline, drop into temperature of 10 degrees Celsius, and you take them to the operating room in a cardiac arrest, do surgical repair, then bring them back up on cardiopulmonary bypass. And I put ECMO in here because some of these patients are still going to need perfusion support afterwards. I just don't know which ones, but it's part of the armamentarium of all this endovascular resuscitation that we are going to be thinking about using to help try to resuscitate our trauma patients. One of the interesting things, very quickly, is that for Reboa, it's really useful for bleeding below the level of the diaphragm. But it's generally considered contraindicated if you're bleeding, especially if your principal bleeding or only bleeding is above the level of the diaphragm. Because then you're not going to get hemorrhage control. If anything, you raise the pressure and you may actually increase the bleeding. So it's considered contraindicated in major thoracic hemorrhage. SAP may not be. I mean, this is early for us trying to sort this out, but if you're in a cardiac arrest state, you don't have a lot to lose by trying SAP. We're going to be pushing fluid into the upper vasculature. We may be able to get resuscitation. And it may not work as well as if the hemorrhage is below, but we may actually have some benefit. But just for fun, we decided to do a hemorrhagic shock model where we did a combination of severe liver hemorrhage, just like we've done before, but we also put a catheter into the pericardium and put in a very large pericardial tamponade. So in our model, and this is about a 30 kilogram pig, we put 200 mils of blood into the pericardium. After going in hemorrhagic shock, they're profoundly hypotensive and they're bradycardic. When you put 200 mils of blood into the pericardium, they go flatline asystolic. I mean, they're gone. I mean, there's nothing. And what we tried to do with using some oxygenated blood was you just wanted to see if with the tamponade in place, if we did SAP, could we get enough perfusion to where, you know, at least the myocardium would be viable so that when we took the tamponade out, the heart might actually be might possibly beat again. Fascinating, I didn't expect this. We only did four of these as a pilot. But what we actually found was when we started the infusion, just a minute or so into the infusion, we got electrical activity back, so that showed, well, okay, it looks like we're perfusing the heart well enough to at least get to restore electrical activity. But then the heart actually started beating and generated a pressure higher than the perfusion pressure we were in. And that we did not expect to see. And here what you see is this is the pressure that the heart is actually generating, is generating a pressure up in the range, you know, mean is probably in the range of about 60 to 70 with the tamponade. Then we took off 50 mils, took off 50 mils, took it all out. And by the time we took all of it out, we had normal pressure again. This was better than we expected. And I was kind of surprised. I thought, well, I didn't expect this to happen. But I think what it tells us is that when people have a tamponade and truly arrest from a tamponade, where the heart is down to where it can't beat anymore, can't generate aortic pressure and flow, there's no coronary flow, so it just stops beating. If you can extracorporeally perfuse the heart, maybe with SAP or maybe even with ECMO, even with a pericardial tamponade, you may get enough perfusion of the myocardium to where you can actually get it to beat a little bit until you get to the OR and relieve the tamponade. Yes?
But this will be a non-penetrating heart injury because then you have tamponade. But if you increase the pressure and stop pumping in the trauma setting, that would increase the outflow and increase of the tamponade, unless the tamponade came from the aorta.
Well, potentially. I mean, that's in our model, we just wanted to create a consistent tamponade to see what would happen if you got a penetrating injury. And the question is, if you close the aortic valve and you're perfusing just the coronaries, it's not backflowing into the, say if it's a left ventricular stab wound. I don't know how much more you'll increase the tamponade doing this perfusion. And this is going to be time limited, but it might buy you time to get you to the OR, get you to the hospital. So this is early. It's just an interesting potential that we might have. So I'll quickly talk about just the medical cardiac arrest aspect of this because, again, I started out with this. And again, the balloon was not for any hemorrhage control or other purpose other than to isolate the heart and brain as much as I could fast in order to perfuse it during cardiac arrest. And I knew it was going to be volume loading, so I wanted all of that oxygenated perfusate to go to the heart and brain as much as possible in order to get return circulation and keep the brain alive. And again, the other things like intra-aortic adrenaline you can use. Oh, by the way, if you want to do therapeutic hypothermia, I can just doing room temperature fluid as a perfusate, you can get to 33, 34 degrees Celsius in less than 5 minutes. So it's a very rapid means of inducing therapeutic hypothermia if you continue to believe in that for your brain. So those are the options that you have. I think because we're running out of time, I'm going to skip, well, just a little bit. Let's see. What this is going to show is that you actually do this perfusion. Like here, we've this is an example where we've put in the bolus, and as we perfuse, actually we gave a little bit of epinephrine with this. You can watch that the pressure actually rises as we begin to get some vasoconstriction. So the perfusion pressure will actually increase if you give a little bit of intra-aortic epinephrine. And then, let's see, I think it's running for about 2 minutes, but essentially what we do is we do this perfusion, and we got, what you can't see, unfortunately, is that I got a V-fib pattern down here, and the V-fib goes from fine V-fib to coarser V-fib to coarser higher energy V-fib, and we get to a point where we're saying, okay, the V-fib pattern looks really great, let's just stop the infusion, fire up the defibrillator, and shock them. And whenever I'm doing this, always, it's amazing. This is only about a minute and a half, but it's amazing how long a minute and a half is. We just stopped the infusion right there. We're charging up the paddles. the V-fib is really good and tight. We shocked them right about here, and boom, return spontaneous circulation. So that's what we hope we will be able to do in human cardiac arrest after only maybe 2, maybe 3 minutes of really active, robust perfusion of the myocardium. This is basically it in case the video didn't work. That's what we did, perfusion, shocked, got it back. Again, you can't see the V-fib, you can't see the V-fib pattern, but it was pretty robust. We've used the hemoglobin-based oxygen carrier. This works really well. This was a model in which we shocked, this is an animal where we shocked a V-fib into a PEA. Very limited electrical activity, no pressure, started the infusion, but we had electrical activity. The electrical activity actually increased again, and then the heart then came back. Nothing else other than oxygenated perfusion. Fundamentally, it's against the things I talked about. Start with an exogenous oxygen carrier, move to autologous blood if necessary, move to letting the balloon down and doing a little bit of perfusion support if you need it as a bridge to get into full body ECMO. And that's sort of the concept. So just mentioning very briefly the idea of using doing endovascular procedures in the field. Well, I don't have to be too convincing because the same you're already putting people on ECMO in the field. And I'm sure there are probably some advanced procedures and stuff that are done here as well. But I pushed the envelope on this back in the early 1990s, around 1993, 1994. I actually managed to get approval to go into the field of cardiac arrest patients, and I was blindly placing thoracic aortic and central venous pressure catheters and measuring coronary perfusion pressure and titrating in doses of intra-aortic epinephrine in the field. And that was blind placement, blind sticks, everything in medical cardiac arrest patients. We wound up doing 22 cardiac arrest patients. We got 11 with return circulation, 50% stable enough to get to the hospital and to the ICU. Unfortunately, the problem was is that the post-resuscitation care and ICU care that we now attempt and hypothermia and everything else didn't exist at the time. And I learned the painful lesson that you can do the most sophisticated care in the world in the field, but if you don't have the whole system that takes you the whole way through, you're not going to have survivors. But I think it is, at least we demonstrated that you can, and certainly I think in Paris they've demonstrated this. They've demonstrated this in London and other physician-staffed ambulances, physician-staffed response cars in Europe have shown that you can go into the field. We can do these really advanced procedures to help save these patients' lives and do them out early where the time frame that allows us to save them often runs out. And I'm an advocate for that. This is how we did it, just as far as that's the measurements, kind of talked about that before. I'll just mention 2 minutes about intra-arterial adrenaline, just because I know that in ACLS people are saying we shouldn't use adrenaline. It's never been shown to be of any benefit. There's no survival benefit long-term, and all the studies have been done, meta-analyses and stuff. And so a lot of people are saying we should just like scrap epinephrine or adrenaline from the ACLS protocols. My viewpoint is not quite yet, and this is my reason. We're just giving it in the wrong place. If you think about it, every drug we give, antibiotic, anything we give people generally intravenously, but we do that without even thinking about the fact that when we push drugs intravenously, that we have an intact circulation that's going to circulate it around the body and to the effector sites that we want it to get to, except in cardiac arrest. In cardiac arrest, there's essentially no flow. And I threw this up. This was from a SMAC talk where I was trying to argue the question that we have this dilemma when it comes to intravenous adrenaline. Those patients that have a really low coronary perfusion pressure, like less than 10 millimeters of mercury, if you push intravenous adrenaline, it's just going to sit in the veins. You're barely going to circulate any of it and get it to the arterial effector sites where you need it to cause vasoconstriction. If you have a patient that has a coronary perfusion pressure of, say, 30 or 35, or really good coronary perfusion pressure, they probably don't need adrenaline because you've already got pretty good vasoconstriction, pretty good flow, and actually, in these, giving adrenaline may actually make things worse. So you probably don't want to give it in these. It's not going to be effective in these. It's only in these ones in the border zone where you've got a little bit of flow, enough to circulate some of that adrenaline, to where you get a hemodynamic effect that really bumps you up critically to where you can get return circulation. These are the ones that are sort of the borderline coronary perfusion pressure that probably can benefit from intravenous adrenaline. But on either side of this, you won't circulate it, or it may actually be deleterious. And if you're old enough like me to remember the days of high dose adrenaline, Who gave high dose adrenaline, like 5, 10 milligrams at a time somewhere back in the history? I did. Because people, but I think what happened, honestly, I think what happened there is we gave 10 milligrams of adrenaline. You gave so much that when you slowly moved about a half or a milligram of that into the arterial tree, you got a vasoconstrictor response. You could get improved return of spontaneous circulation, which was shown. But then what happened as soon as you got return of spontaneous circulation? You mobilized the other 9 milligrams of overdose that you didn't need, and then you shut them down adrenergically, and they died in the intensive care unit. So there was no improvement in survival because we basically killed them with an overdose of adrenaline. However, if you give it intra-aortic, you can give very small amounts of adrenaline intra-aortic, and the effect that you will see, the hemodynamic effect of intra-aortic adrenaline, you will see in about 30 to 50 seconds. So within a minute, in less than a minute, you will actually see the maximal effect. What that means is that you can give small doses, and when I went into the field and I did those 22 cardiac arrest patients, I would start with 250 micrograms. I'd start with a quarter of a standard dose. And I would, in some of those, that's all I gave. That was all I needed to give. In some, I had to give two doses. I never, ever gave any of those 22 human cardiac arrest with an aortic catheter. I never gave any of them more than one full milligram of adrenaline during a cardiac arrest to get return of spontaneous circulation. Most of the time, it was less. And my argument is that that's because I was giving it effectively directly to the effector sites. And so you could get, and the thing is, if you've got an arterial catheter in, you can measure the pressure, you can see the hemodynamic effect, you can titrate the precise dose of adrenaline that you need to get return of circulation without giving them an overdose. So my, I'm just throwing this in at the end, because this is one of the things you can do with selective aortic arch perfusion. But this is how, if we're going to give adrenaline, this is how we should probably be giving it. Of course, you have to have an arterial cannula in to do that somewhere. So it all kind of like ties together. I just thought I'd throw that out because I don't think we give up on adrenaline quite yet. It may actually be beneficial, but only in small amounts properly placed.
What about old school intracardiac injections? We used to do that back in time.
Yeah, and you know, the thing, I guess the question is, if you could reliably make sure that you hit the left ventricle, that might do it. If you hit the right ventricle, it's going to be similar to, because our comparison group, I didn't throw the slide in here. I don't think it did. I didn't throw the slide in. I did central venous adrenaline versus aortic arch adrenaline. And despite the fact that in a laboratory model, we're doing everything exactly the same and giving the adrenaline about as effectively as you can intravenously, directly into the right atrium, the response rate where some did great, some barely did anything, it's all over the place. But if you do it intra-aortic and blast it out into the periphery, if you look at every one of these, the interesting thing, the fascinating thing about this is that the response that you get to the intra-aortic adrenaline dose depends on what your coronary perfusion pressure is beforehand. If you look at this, I mean, the ones that are lower down here, I mean, we've got a good response. I got maximal response within less than 30 seconds, but then it plateaued. But this is lower here than these up here. I mean, look at how, this isn't a model where I'm doing exactly the same thing in every animal. I'm trying to make it as consistent as possible. And look at how wide the difference is in the pressures to the same dose of adrenaline, even when you're trying to do everything exactly the same. But interestingly, if you look at the curve of, down here is actually the pre-adrenaline coronary perfusion pressure. This is the post-maximal, you know, adrenaline coronary perfusion pressure. And you see that's about the most linear line I've ever gotten out of research data. I mean, you can predict what the response will be based on where you start. So if I've got somebody that I'm actually measuring their coronary perfusion pressure and their coronary perfusion pressure is like 15 or 20, I probably only need to give them just like a quarter milligram of adrenaline to be able to get them back. If they're really lower, like 10, it's probably going to take a half milligram or more. But the thing is that you know the pressure, you have a guide, and when you give the adrenaline, you can actually then see what the response is. So, again, I think this is one of those things, when you tie all this together into vascular, you've got monitoring capability to see what's going on, you have the ability to perfuse, hemorrhage control if there's hemorrhage, and that's why I just think if we really want to fundamentally change our cardiac arrest outcomes, it's going to take something like this. We're going to have to go endovascular and do something that gives us robust perfusion and gives us good monitoring about what's going on so that we can titrate the level of care. Instead of everybody getting the rote algorithm for asystole, no matter how they got there, we're going to tailor the care to the individual patient and their responses. And I think that does it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Howard, if there are any other questions, I'm happy to try to answer anything I can, but I know you're all the busy folks, so you may need to go somewhere.
I was out for a while, so maybe you addressed it already. Did you talk about the trauma surgeons, the more traditional ones, those who are in the chest?
Right.
Yeah. They talk about the risk of an intrathoracic vascular injury and you going up with a balloon in the middle of the danger zone, and that will be increased bleeding, for example.
Right. If they have a transected aorta.
Yeah.
I think if you have a transected aorta, that's probably the one instance where I'm going, like, okay, if you have a transected aorta, selective aortic arch perfusion is probably not going to be optimal. On the other hand, if they're in a cardiac arrest, their back's against the wall. What are you going to do? And the thing is if they have not completely, say if somebody's got a transection, they're hypotensive, they bled, but it's a sort of contained hematoma. If you look at it, when we're doing this perfusion, when we're doing the SAP, the pressures are not that high. We're talking about pressures, if we don't give adrenaline, of 25, maybe 30 millimeters of mercury. That's not exactly huge pressures. But I don't really care about the pressure so long as we have the perfusion. And we know we have the perfusion because we know how much fluid we're putting into that catheter. So we may actually be able to, in some of those instances, even with a thoracic injury, a thoracic aortic injury, we may be able to, if under cardiac arrest, perfuse them well enough to get the heart beating again, supply the heart and the brain enough, and then hopefully you get them to the OR and the operating theater and your surgeons can take care of this. If they completely free rupture into their left hemithorax and you're just pouring into the left hemithorax, until we come up with something better, that's kind of game over at this point. I mean, what else are you going to do? So it's I think it's an issue. And yes, when you're doing catheterizations like this, we could potentially have like a dissection or injury. So there could be something that could happen with the placement of the catheter itself. Is there a possibility of having adverse effects from the catheter itself? Yes, of course there are. That's a reality. On the other hand, we're talking about people in cardiac arrest. I can only hurt them so much. I mean, and if you actually have a complication, you could argue that you survived your cardiac arrest long enough to have that complication.
I think you're right, and I think they mostly address for like peri-arrest patients,
right,
with 40, 50 milligrams of,
right,
mercury, where you possibly could engrave the injury.
Right, yeah. And this, I think, Reboa, it's almost a little more of an agony about whether you use Reboa or not because you've got a perfusing patient.
Mm-hmm.
If they're in a cardiac arrest, you know, at least I'm sort of pragmatic to look at it. I can only do so much harm if the heart's not beating. And, you know, we got to do something. So,
what about clinical data?
What about clinical data? As far as clinical data with SAP, I'd love to think a year from now I could come back here and tell you about the first patients we put this in. We have we've established relationships with our primary clinical sites for trauma right now as first in man. Our Royal London Hospital with Karen Brohe as the PI,
okay.
Maryland Shock Trauma with Tom Scalia having said, yeah, we want to do it. The University of Alabama, Birmingham, so we have two trauma sites in the United States, one in Europe, that being right now, and then for medical cardiac arrest, we're looking to collaborate with the SAMU in Paris to do this there for medical cardiac arrest to start. And if we can get it up and running, if we can show some benefit, and you're interested, I'd love to come back and talk with you about it.
Another thought, we talk about coronary perfusion pressure, it's a downstream pressure as well, that would be like the CVP or the wedge pressure, whatever we measure, which is basically unknown in this setting. I mean, if you put in the catheter, you would see the aortic pressure, right?
Right.
But you wouldn't see the downstream pressure. I mean, and so you wouldn't really know the coronary perfusion pressure in the sense that some patients may have a high CVP, hyperbleeding patients may have a low CVP and so forth.
Right, right. Specifically with the aortic catheter alone, you're not going to know the coronary perfusion pressure unless you do like what I did, where you went out and put central venous pressure and you got both of them, and then you can calculate it right online.
Of course, but you probably wouldn't have time to do that in the coronary arrest, or maybe, I don't know.
I'm right. It'd be wonderful to know that. I think from a practical standpoint, if I can get the aortic catheter and begin to perfuse and I know I've got good perfusion, I'm hopefully going to know in 2 to 3 minutes whether we're going to actually begin to win that, you know, by something, either by return of electrical activity that's organized or improvement in ventricular fibrillation waveform to give me some clear idea that we're getting closer to being able to get return of circulation. Yeah, would it be great to have a central venous catheter in to know? Yes, but when we're doing the active perfusion, it's probably less critical at that moment. But I think it's the question of what do you do to optimize the outcome for the patient? And probably trying to waiting, I would start the infusion immediately. And then even when I was putting in aortic catheters, I would start to, even before I could get the, because I put the aortic catheter in first, then put the central venous catheter in second. And I would start to optimize CPR based on diastolic aortic pressure and push in doses of intra-aortic adrenaline before I could get the venous catheter in. And in a couple of the instances, we actually got return of circulation so fast I didn't even get the central venous catheter in. So, but if you have it, it's better.
Because I thought about the Tampa model you showed us, they would probably have a very high CVP, right?
Oh, yes.
And low perfusion pressure.
Right.
Despite having a higher aortic pressure.
Right. And what you'll find is when we do SAP, you watch the right atrial pressures go up significantly as we're perfusing and going arterial to venous flow. The right atrial pressure, we're perfusing, but you're watching the right atrial pressure go up substantially. It can go up to like 30, 35 millimeters of mercury. But what we've seen so far is once we get return of circulation, the heart starts beating, it starts coming back down and redistributes. And I guess my thought is that I don't really like driving the CVP up that high, but if I can get the heart beating again and then it corrects fairly quickly, okay, I'll accept that.
Yeah. What's the oxygen content of red pack, stored red pack cell, if you just take one that's available instantly?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Oh, I know. I think the oxygen content can be actually, quite high. I mean, the oxygen carrying capability is high. Yeah, it's great. Actually, a fascinating thing we did this Wednesday is we actually took some oxygenated arterial blood and just measured the PO2 on it over a series of days when it's just sitting on the shelf. And it's remarkable how little the PO2 goes down over a period of up to like 4 days. It's still got PO2s well in the hundreds. If you start out with like 400, you're still in the 300s, mid 300s, 4 days later. It's remarkable. The problem I see more with, say, blood is not so much its oxygen carrying content, but if the blood's been sitting around for an extended period of time, and you've lost the 2-3 DPG and the oxygen association curve has actually shifted, what kind of oxygen offloading in the tissues do you get? That's more my worry with, say, something like blood, which is also another reason why it'd be nice to be able to use something like a hemoglobin oxygen carrier. And for example, one we've been testing is like room temperature stable for like 3, 5, 7 years. I mean, it's like that gives you a significant advantage, and you can be sure that the consistency of what you're getting in terms of calcium, potassium concentrations, and oxygen association curve, all of those things are consistent. That's why something like that would be optimal for this, especially if you're trying to go into the field as opposed to, say, blood products. Because I think if you're pushing this into the aorta, you'd like to have as fresh a blood as possible so that you don't have a really high potassium and you've actually got blood that actually will offload oxygen at the tissues. So I think it probably depends on how long has the blood been sitting on the shelf. Maybe more pertinent to the answer to your question than what is it, typically like right off the bat. That's a big question.
The calcium chloride that you give intra-aortically, you give it to bind to the citrate, but yeah, it probably has a lot of other effects, cardiac effects. It might have membrane stabilizing effects.
Yeah, absolutely can. Well, what we've done when we've used blood, either red packed red cells or whole blood, is we try to just match the calcium so that we have a perfusate that has a normal ionized calcium. As a matter of fact, we want it to be normal. We don't want it to be low. We don't want it to be high. Because if you've got a very low ionized calcium in the perfusate or very high, it's a wonderful model for refractory ventricular fibrillation. You have to get it right. But that's, let's face it, in our world, everything's got a normal range, and probably even oxygen does, and you got to have it in the normal range. Because if you've probably done this, if it makes sense, is if you take a unit of blood that you're giving your next patient, if you actually draw a small amount of it and do a blood gas on that packed red cells that you're about to give, the ionized calcium is undetectable because it's all bound by citrate. And if you're pushing it directly into the heart through a catheter like this, the heart's seeing exactly what you're pushing in, so you've got to normalize the calcium. So we match the two as it's going into the catheter.
Have you
What about giving them nitrate in that course?
Should they make a second?
Nitrate would be an endodermic.
Right.
Of second acidotic.
Right.
And it would probably be good for reproducing injury.
I agree. Clear. We have actually done studies where we've looked at combining. Actually, what we'd use was nitroglycerin combined with the HBOC-201, the hemoglobin, because acellular hemoglobin has some nitric oxide scavenging. So we've actually tried to reverse that with nitroglycerin, which you can. You can actually reverse it, but you have to keep giving the nitroglycerin because nitroglycerin has a lot shorter half-life than the hemoglobin. So you can do it, and we've done that. That's the limit of what we've done so far. But I think it's one of the things, especially if we go to doing SAP with an HBOC, we may actually very well want to be adding in nitroglycerin or nitrate, something like that, in order to help have the potential effects that you're describing and also counteracting any possible adverse effects maybe from the hemoglobin itself. Great question. Anything else?
I have a question about the definition of coronary perfusion pressure. All the literature is speaking about it being, as you mentioned, diastolic aortic pressure minus right atrial pressure. But for me, after a bit of thinking, that is somewhat like saying that the cerebral perfusion pressure is mean arterial pressure minus CDP and not minus ICP. Because we believe that there is some waterfall mechanism regarding cerebral perfusion, but that might also be the case with cardiac perfusion, with coronary perfusion, that we're actually trying to look at the difference between diastolic aortic pressure and left ventricular, like intramural pressure.
Interesting. It's an interesting question. I don't know that anybody's really ever addressed that. In any effective way. I'm not aware of anything. I've certainly one of the things I found when I've actually done studies on this, trying to look at coronary perfusion pressure, is that yes, the greatest gradient and therefore theoretically the greatest flow occurs during the CPR diastolic phase. I will tell you that at least when you're giving intra-aortic adrenaline, and you get a high enough coronary perfusion pressure during the diastolic phase of CPR, if you look at the arterial side and the venous side, you actually begin to get pretty good gradients on the arterial side. I mean, during the systolic phase as well. If you get enough vasoconstriction, that gradient's not just during the diastolic phase, it's also to some degree during the arterial phase. During the systolic phase. That doesn't answer your question, though. You're asking what happened.
In the beating heart, you're not perfusing during systole, and that is because not because CDP is abnormally high during systole, right. It's because the intramural pressure.
Exactly,
is high.
Exactly.
So, and that would be the same thing when we're doing compression, decompression CPR, that during compression we can't really have such a good perfusion or flow because we're having such a large left ventricular. Pressure, like the
Exactly. So how much is the effect of, say, the intramyocardial wall pressure during CPR? Yeah. I don't really have a good answer to that. I think there's some limited data on what's the actual ventricular pressure like. Somebody tried to measure that, but I don't know that anybody's actually really tried to tease out those gradients. It's a good question. I wish I had a better answer for you. It makes sense. The only thing about it is that those pressures are because the heart's not beating, and the vascular pressures are otherwise low. The intramyocardial pressure during CPR is still going to be substantially lower than when the heart's actually beating, intrinsically. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have an effect. It's a good question. I know I'm way over time. Y'all have been great to stay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.